Welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How are you doing, Brian?
Oh, well, you know, Sean, they talk about the Christmas season full of festivity and love. I think it's full of consumerism, too many parties, too much drinking, and a lot of stress. How about you?
Same, plus super as always.
You are always super, aren't you?
Yes, I long to not be super, yet I have no choice. I've also got a little bit of a cold, so dear listeners, do bear with me.
Well, you know what, Sean? Given the stress of the holiday season, it only seems appropriate that we give ourselves some gifts, I would say. The world has given us a few gifts recently. Things like Saoirse Ronan back on the award circuit.
Yeah, Doug Jones in Alabama, that's a gift.
Yes, that's a gift. And, you know, I said to myself some time ago, when you and I were looking at the lineup for our first six actresses on The Good, the Bad, and the Crazy. Now, we won't quite reveal all the inner workings of Broad Appeal and the strategy.
And the spreadsheets on a train.
Yes, there were spreadsheets on a train, which is the very boring sequel to Strangers on a Train. On that original spreadsheet, there was a different actress as the sixth one that we were going to close off the year with. But you know what? I said, like Andy McDowell, I'm worth it. And I had an intervention because I looked and I said, if this episode is coming out just before Christmas, there's no way we can deal with that other person that we will deal with later. I'm going to give myself a gift, and that gift is Emma Thompson.
Yes, this was a tremendous act of self-love, was it not? Well, Brian, I'm giving you an even bigger gift. I'm giving you 3 episodes to talk about Emma Thompson.
But this is not going to be a monologue. It's a bit like, you know, if you were to go and you were to interview someone who is an adherent to a particular religion. So it's very interesting to hear the person talk about their own faith, to recite the Nicene Creed, and to go on and on about transubstantiation or the pillars of Islam or whatever it might be. But it's also very interesting to hear from the perspective of someone outside of that particular cult.
Yeah, someone who finds it all very suspicious and thinks they're going to have to part with all their money.
Or perhaps someone who is ready to be converted.
Yes, maybe. Now, we should just point out to your listeners that Brian Mullen has a particular affinity to Emma Thompson, and we racked our brains to think if there was an equivalent actress for me, and there's not. Brian Mullen has a fervent, deep, one might say, unhealthy connection with Emma Thompson. And today's episode is very important to Brian, so I am giving him the gift of talking to it at length, with the caveat that he has to ask me some questions along the way.
Well, of course I am going to ask you some questions. I mean, my affection for Emma Thompson is in some ways an accident of history. The age that I am, the time that I was in high school, the time when you're of the age where you start choosing movies yourself, you have the ability to go on public transportation or drive in a car and go see movies, rent films by yourself that aren't chosen by your parents. That was the exact time of an incredible period in British independent art film. We can only call it Emma Thompson's Imperial Phase.
Yes, the Imperial Phase.
Yes, from about 1989 to 1995, suddenly this woman, if you paid attention at all to prestige art filmmaking coming from Britain and Europe, she was everywhere.
Yeah, she was untouchable. Are there any equivalent actresses who also have imperial phases, just so we can use them as parallel examples?
It's hard to talk about another imperial phase that I think was so all-consuming and yet weirdly so brief. So if I could just point out, from 1992 to 1995, Emma Thompson received 6 Oscar nominations.
Wow.
And won 2 of them.
Well, that is definitely, using my arithmetic skills, that's definitely at least more than one in some years. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, there are people, you know, for instance, Kate Blanchett, who kind of has definitely gone through periods of time where she, you know, had successive nominations in a row. Obviously, there's marvelous Meryl Streep.
Yeah, you could say that her imperial phase began in 1979, ended in 1992.
Yeah.
Or maybe 1989.
It's waxed and waned.
Yeah, and then began, like, Meryl is definitely in an imperial phase.
Let's say Meryl is a marathon runner. Emma Thompson is a sprinter. She's Usain Bolt. And, you know, Meryl is Mo Farah.
Yeah,
or
Meryl,
something like that.
Meryl is the loneliness of the long distance runner. And Emma Thompson is another film about running. That's about sprinting.
Yeah, Chariots of Fire.
That's sprinting, though. I don't think that's cross country.
Okay.
Or something.
Dun, 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 dun. Anyway.
Actually, movies about sprinting probably aren't that interesting.
They're short
because
films.
Because the race is over pretty quickly.
They're just short films. So anyway, it's hard to find a comparable imperial phase. I mean, I don't know. Maybe if we had been around at the time, like the meteoric rise of Jennifer Jones in the 1940s or something like that. You know, she was obviously the paramour of David O. Selznick and he groomed her for stardom. I think the interesting thing is that Emma popped up first on the coattails of Ken Branagh.
Her then husband.
He popped through first with Henry V. And also other projects like Much Ado About Nothing, which she's also in. I think people quickly realized that she was her own unique screen presence. It was not just the Ken and Em show. And in fact, the times at the Oscars that Emma actually won, she showed up not with Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, but at this point, I believe they were divorcing her. Had divorced, is that correct?
Well, by the time she did Sense and Sensibility, yes. But even in 1992, when she won for Howard's End and was still married to Ken, she showed up with her mother, Phyllida Law, and she did not thank Kenneth Branagh in her acceptance speech. I will also say, listeners, I'm sorry to have foisted upon you another Emma Thompson episode, when in fact we've already done two of them.
What was the second one?
Primary Colors.
Oh, yeah, but you know what? That first season is a bit like the first season of RuPaul's Drag Race. It exists, but we don't have to acknowledge it.
That's not true. There's some for those of you who haven't gone back to the first season, there are some wonderful, lovely, short episodes in there.
Hey, these episodes are short, just that there's three of them in a week.
Season one was films of the 90s, and I made the error, the grave error, of trying to think of an Emma Thompson movie we could watch and picking Dead Again.
Yeah, for episode two. This is why I'm the producer of the show now, and Brian is just the editor. Editrix.
I'm the Thelma Schoonmaker to your Scott Rudin. Anyway, we picked Dead Again, which is a poor movie in many ways, but poor in particular because there's just not enough Emma in it.
And too much Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, it's a very much a Ken Branagh movie with his directorial fingerprints all over it.
Yeah, and his missing top lip.
Which, you know, he's decided to completely obscure in Murder on the Orient Express with an insane prosthetic mustache.
I know. Well, you know, the thing of it is, Kenneth Branagh has no top lip, and I said this before in the podcast, but people with no chins shouldn't throw stones in glass houses, so I also have a relatively thin top lip, but I do have one. Kenneth Branagh just does not have one.
Is that the pot calling the kettle black?
It's the pot calling the other pot black.
And speaking of pots, Emma also played Mrs. Potts in Beauty and the Beast just this past year.
She did, yes.
She did indeed. We didn't go see it. So, what was I saying? Dead Again. But I did promise Sean that this wouldn't be a monologue, and it's already becoming one. So, before you and I got into our very special relationship, which you didn't, I think, know it would be a three-way relationship with a young man and Emma Thompson.
Who's the young man?
Me.
Okay.
So, little did you know that you were marrying Emma Thompson. What did you think of her, about her, know about her before I started indoctrinating you?
Well, you know what the cool thing is? When actresses get to a certain age, I think in contemporary times, actresses go under this kind of metamorphosis all over again. And Emma Thompson suddenly became this very glamorous, quite gorgeous, affable grand dame who, when she turns up at something, you know it's a sign of quality and prestige. I'm thinking about the time she hosted at the Golden Globe Awards, where she was holding her Louboutins in her hand. Do you remember?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I just remember looking at her, and she had this like platinum blonde hair. She had this fitted dress that was like a William Morris print all over her. she just looked fantastic. And I remember thinking, you know, I think in the 90s, women in their 50s didn't get to look like this. I think this has been one of the good things about this recent century. Older women are allowed to just be everything. And I think she is everything.
Emma really pops up when you least expect her, commenting on political issues. I mean, literally everything. Most recently, there was a much retweeted interview that she did about Harvey Weinstein, where she talked about power and bullying, you know, really on the day or so after the Harvey Weinstein scandal broke. But she's been vocal on Brexit. She's been vocal on tax evasion.
Yeah.
Yeah, corporate tax evasion. Do you know, I really would like to know if she and Greg Wise have paid their taxes.
Yeah, I have a feeling they probably have.
Going far back, I remember reading, when I was still in high school, the unauthorized biography Ken and Em, and learning that Emma was quite vocal during the first Gulf War in 1990.
And now, were you reading this...
Against the war. Let me just say, against the war, General Schwarzkopf.
Were you reading this biography while you were downing 40s at local frat parties?
If by downing 40s you mean sipping tea while watching Merchant Ivory films and reading books about Stephen Sondheim, then yes. But no, honestly, when I got to college and people were saying, like, let's get some 40s, I didn't know what they were except for the decade in which Bette Davis reigned supreme in Hollywood.
Yeah, the only 40s you were into were Barbara Stanwyck's.
Shawnee, sorry, that was a mild diversion. We were talking about your history with Emma Thompson. Yes,
once
remember?
Again, we've made it all about you. Interesting. Just note, dear listener, how often that happens in this episode.
Okay, I am going to get back to that, but I'm just going to say, Emma, as a screen presence, would never do what I'm doing right now. And we can talk about this when we get to today's film. Emma's genius as an actor is to be receptive with her partners. They are often speaking more, she is looking, she is emoting. It's often when Emma is silent and things are expressed through her eyes that she is at her best. And then she lets rip with emotional outbursts or wry comments from the side. So maybe I should take a lesson from Emma herself and let you, Sir Anthony Hopkins, the knight of my life, say a little bit more about your adolescent encounters with Emma.
So the first time I ever saw Emma Thompson in anything was that masterpiece in gender flipping and sexual deconstruction, Junior, which actually is a very, very good film. I don't know, keep that in. I think it's a good film. I remember enjoying it, but the interesting thing about Junior is I remember being like 8 or 9 when I saw it and thinking, who is this woman? She's great. And Junior is a ridiculous film, but her and Arnold Schwarzenegger have the nicest chemistry, don't you think?
Well, I haven't seen it in a very long time, not since Thanksgiving, honestly, of whatever year it was that movie came out. You wouldn't expect, you know, liberal prestige actress Emma Thompson to really make it work with Republican Muscle Mary Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, but he's a California Republican.
Okay, so was Ronald Reagan, but anyway. Emma's given some hilarious talk show interviews, like with David Letterman and Jay Leno and those types, where she talks about their meeting on the set and the hilarious conversations they had.
Yeah, I believe he lifted her up, didn't he?
Yeah, and told her how much body fat percentage he estimated that she had.
Yeah.
Whether that's exaggeration or not, I don't know.
But I think in that film, what I love about Schwarzenegger around this time is that he tried to play the nerdy loser, but he also has the body of a god. It's like...
Well, it's also like, who does she play in that? Is she like a scientist?
She plays a scientist who has no children, and she puts her eggs on ice.
Mm.
And he takes her eggs and impregnates them in him with his own semen, is that correct?
Or Danny DeVito's?
No, I think it's his own semen. It's his semen and random eggs.
I'm certainly hoping that the discussion of semen and eggs is dealt with very quickly, because it would gross out, you know, the PG-13 audience.
They probably call it DNA. Do you
yes,
notice that?
Probably
whenever in movies that are about, like, you know, bodily fluids and reproduction but are for a family, it's always about DNA. It's like this episode of Star Trek Voyager where Chakotay impregnates, I believe, character is called Seska, I think. And in the episode, she's like, I took your DNA. And I remember watching it with my mother and being like, DNA, you know?
Do you think Emma Thompson should be on Star Trek? She'd be good.
She would, actually. I'm quite liking this new series. She'd be good on it.
So,
Back to me.
Go.
That was the first time I ever saw an Emma Thompson film. But the first time I ever actually looked at her was many, many times, many occasions, on the VHS cassette for Adam's Family Values.
Mm.
So on Adam's Family Values, there were three trailers. One was for a general trailer for whoever released it, maybe MGM, I'm not quite sure. Then there was a trailer for the Holly Hunter film, also starring Tom Cruise, called The Firm. And then there was a trailer for Sense and Sensibility, which is the film we're doing today. And every single time Sense and Sensibility would come on, I would fast forward it, because I was not into pretty dresses, lawns, old houses, people looking sad, and then people looking happy. You know,
you preferred people just looking neutral all the way through a film.
But also, I dare I say, the trailer for it probably didn't do it justice like a lot of 90s trailers did.
Yeah, but how would you even have known? Because apparently you didn't even watch the
trailer. No, I watched it at least once to know I didn't want to see it.
Now, here I have a question. Did you watch the trailer for The Firm and then fast forward the trailer for Sense and Sensibility?
Well, I would fast forward The Firm, but I know for a fact that I watched the trailer for The Firm more times than I watched Sense and Sensibility. Because ultimately, this sums you and I up perfectly. There was a trailer for Sense and Sensibility, which I completely disregarded, to quickly get to that completely sardonic black comedy Adam's Family Values. I didn't care about Emma Thompson or Kate Winslet. All I wanted was Joan Cusack as Debbie Jelinski. That was what I was aiming for. Well, that's who I aspired to be.
Darling, you know that, like Walt Whitman, I contain multitudes, and I also enjoy Joan Cusack in many things, but one can appreciate Joan and Emma. So what you're saying to me is, your very youthful 8-year-old self responded instinctively to Emma, barely even knowing who she was.
We'll say 9, 10, maybe.
Okay. Then at a somewhat later point, after you'd been socialized to think that costume dramas and British things were, you know, not mask enough for you, you rejected Emma. And now you're in a different phase. So I guess what I'm asking is, what does Emma Thompson mean to you? What is her unique place in the pantheon of female stars?
She is very thoughtful. She has a great sense of humor. Is not afraid to laugh at herself, most of all. She probably is a bit naive, thinking that The Love Punch is a film that young people want to see. Willfully naive. And I think also she probably struggles with the roles that a lot of women of her age should be doing.
That imperial phase that we talked about, it really did end, more or less, with Sense and Sensibility.
Yeah, the passing of the torch back to Meryl.
Yeah, because Meryl was nominated that same year for The Bridges of Madison County, and she came back to her ascendance as the leading prestige actress. Of course, they're not the same age. Emma is significantly younger than Meryl. You know, Emma had a few other big films, both commercial films and art house films. She was coming off a long run of artistic success that I think also came with some personal cost. If you listen to Emma on Desert Island Discs, I really recommend anyone who loves Emma to seek that out on the BBC iPlayer, because she's really open about her struggles with mental health issues and depression, which I'm pretty sure she pinpoints to around this time as her marriage with Kenneth Branagh was breaking up. She was trying to write the screenplay for Sense and Sensibility and found herself just like moping around her house. And you also get this if you read the diaries, the published diaries that are connected with the screenplay of Sense and Sensibility, which of course I have in my house and have read. You know, she and Kate Winslet are both going through difficult times, difficult low self-esteem while making this film, and Emma is very open about that. I think she very consciously made a choice after this period to choose projects in a different way and to focus on different things. She ended up remarrying, this time with Greg Wise, who is also in Sense and Sensibility, who is not as big a star or as big an ego as Ken Branagh. They have a baby. They've also become really involved in political activism and charity work. They've been very open about their assistance that they've given to this young man from Rwanda, who they've helped to send through Oxbridge, and he's now a human rights attorney or something. I mean, she's just living the life of, like, your best, you know, liberal British person, as far as I can tell. on screen, I think Emma, she sort of weirdly went into her dowager phase earlier than she needed to.
Yeah, with Nanny McPhee.
Well, yeah, there's Nanny McPhee, which was a big hit, and obviously she can't blame anyone else. She wrote the damn thing and she produced it. And
didn't she produce a couple of sequels as well?
And there's at least one sequel.
Yeah, Nanny McPhee and the Golden Bowl or something.
But it was even before Nanny McPhee that she was being a dowager. She's the prim headmistress in An Education with Carey Mulligan.
Oh.
She's Lady Marchmain in Brideshead Revisited. And, I mean, also in things like Last Chance Harvey. And, I mean, even when you're talking about Junior, and she's like a woman who hasn't had a mate and she's freezing her eggs. And that was like back in the mid-90s. I think there is something about Emma's self-deprecatingness that she doesn't want to play as sexy and glamorous, as desirable as she is. She either plays that for laughs, or she sort of downplays it into kind of like, I'm too smart for men to like me, or I'm too strident or something. She won an Emmy, I'm pretty sure, for Wit, the Mike Nichols theater adaptation, which she's quite brilliant in.
Let's not forget Angels in America, which she was also excellent in.
I mean, she's excellent in almost everything that she pops up in. In her film roles, she's become quite desexualized in a certain way, while, as you're saying, her award show appearances, she's funny and uninhibited and glamorous and gorgeous. Anyway, there's much more that I could say about Emma overall, and I'm sure I will, but let's focus in on that film whose trailer you fast-forwarded so many times. It's a film that I will say is probably, definitely, the best Jane Austen work ever adapted to the screen, with the possible exception of Clueless. That film is Sense and Sensibility, directed by Ang Lee, with an Oscar-winning screenplay by Emma herself. Okay, Sean, you fast-forwarded the trailer. You could barely contain your ardor for Debbie Jelinski. I've now had you watch Sense and Sensibility all the way through. What is your blanket verdict?
Well, Brian, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed every moment of it. I didn't nod off, text, or anything during it. It was fabulous.
Did you laugh? Did you cry? Did you emote?
I laughed a lot, yeah. I emoted plenty. I just enjoyed how beautiful it was, and also really appreciated that it was directed by a non-British person. In fact, not even a European, Ang Lee from Taiwan. I think his unique vision and her unique screenplay just combined to make a genuinely fascinating film.
Yeah, it's a funny history. So apparently, producer Lindsay Duran had long wanted to adapt Jane Austen's first published novel, often considered one of her minor works that she got better as she wrote Pride and Prejudice and Emma. She couldn't find the right person to write the screenplay until she was watching a late-night rerun of a now-canceled British variety show called Thompson, which starred then stand-up comedian Emma, and writing most of her own skits, some of which were like Victorian literary parodies. And she said, who is this woman? She's the one who has to write my screenplay. They brought on Sidney Pollack, the great Sidney Pollack, as a producer. But
was he ever intended to direct it, do you know?
That is a good question that I don't know the answer to. At that time, Ang Lee had directed things like The Wedding Banquet and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. He was known for doing these, you know, comedies of manners that were very much about social codes and gender relations and romance, but they were all from an Asian perspective. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure he had never directed a film entirely in the English language.
Yeah, now this is Columbia Pictures, wasn't it?
Yes.
If I'm correct, because Annette Bening appears at the very start of it, waving her torch. Yeah.
Yes, if anyone has never carefully scrutinized the Columbia Pictures woman, it is totally Annette Bening posing as the Statue of Liberty.
Yes, and with that logic, it also means that it's me posing as the Statue of Liberty.
Sean has a striking resemblance to Annette Bening with a mustache.
Yes, look at the grifters.
Okay, so anyway,
so what I'm interested in is that, like, what conversations and how many of them were there with everyone involved to say, okay, let's get this Taiwanese director who's never made an English language film before to direct this quintessentially British novel. Like, I'm genuinely fascinated by that. I mean, obviously, giving projects to Ang Lee now is not a risk because we know that he's a double Oscar-winning bankable director, but I just want to know, you know, who finally rubber stamped that? Because it was a stroke of genius.
Well, but the other thing I would say is they ended up, you know, using British acting talent across the board, and people like Jenny Bevan and Patrick Doyle and all the kind of Merchant Ivory, Ken Branagh craft people. But I did actually recently read an interview with Lindsay Duran where she was just saying, you know, when Americans and a Taiwanese person come over to Britain to do this literary adaptation, there's all these things that British people are telling them they can't do. So there would be scenes...
The British people telling people things they can't do. Interesting.
So, like eating any food that's not a potato. Anyway, there would be scenes where they'd be on a hillside and there would be these beautiful, like, yellow flowers. And Lindsay Duran and Ang Lee would be like, oh, that's a great shot with those beautiful flowers. And then literally every British person would be like, actually, I think you'll know that those flowers were introduced into the country in 1875. And everyone who watches the film will know that. So it's, you know, it's historically inaccurate. Or they were going to have people have, like, various types of facial hair. And they were like, well, no, gentlemen in this period would not have that facial hair. So
that's legitimately correct.
Well, it may be.
The flowers, I think, is pushing it a little bit.
The flowers is pushing it. But here I think it comes down to a philosophical insight that probably transposes from Ang Lee's Eastern background into Jane Austen's conception of sense and sensibility. I'm not coming up with this myself. Emma talks about it in the diaries, where she talks about having chats with Ang Lee about Taoism and yin and yang. So here's my question to you, Sean. Can you define for me what sense is and what sensibility is and how this has to do with the movie?
Oh, Drat, I was going to ask you that question.
I'm sure you can do this.
I'm guessing that sense is about, like, the perception, like, the inner workings of the head. So it's kind of like a very considered, very thoughtful and reasoned attitude to things. That's, I'm guessing, what sense is. Like, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Like, yeah, sense. In this, it's sense coming from the
head. Common sense, yeah. And sensibility, I'm guessing, is about behaviors and emotions and performances and affectations?
Yeah, absolutely. It's about whether you're guided by your head or your instincts. Yeah?
And so sensibility is by your instincts.
Yeah, your instincts, your passions, your natural qualities versus reason.
With head versus heart, basically.
Yeah, that would be one way of putting it. I'm sure some Jane Austen scholars will write in to tell us that we're oversimplifying. How does that have to do with Ang Lee? How does that have to do with the central characters of this film?
Well, I'm guessing that he comes from a culture that also has various manners, social manners as well. He's contrasting his perception of social manners to what British ones look like and how British people behave. And I think probably he is using his Taoist, you know, glasses to look through, to look at British behavior and think, okay, what is this jigsaw puzzle of emotion?
Well, it's interesting because, like, if you think of Ang Lee's other films, and we've mentioned some of his Asian films, but his big breakthrough English language and Hollywood films, aren't they all about repression and release?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, The Hulk,
yeah,
is the most obvious one because it's about being a normal man and then being a screaming green ogre creature.
Yes, which is Kate Winslet in this instance, yes. But also, what about Brokeback Mountain?
Yeah, it's about being the recalcitrant macho shepherd and then being loving and tender and horny with a man.
It is all about this idea of duality, that the human experience is about this war between two types of duality. And in the Jane Austen, as adapted by Emma Thompson, that duality is embodied by two sisters, Eleanor and Marianne. Apparently, Emma was really dubious about taking on this role. The screenplay had been in development for such a long time that she thought she was probably too old to be playing Eleanor, but she'd become such a big star. And I think it totally works, even though she probably is a bit...
She probably is a bit too old, and that's only contrasted by the fact that she has, like, a 9-year-old sister.
Yeah.
Like, I think if the kid weren't there, it would be a bit more believable. You know what I mean?
Of course, Kate Winslet, just to be clear, is not 9 years old. There's an additional sister.
Oh, yeah.
Margaret.
Yes.
Who's kind of a minor player. But also, Kate Winslet, at this time, was not a big star. She'd been in Heavenly Creatures.
Great film.
Yeah, but this Sense and Sensibility was her first major, you know, prestige role, and she got an Oscar nomination herself. Now, Sean, do you want to just tell us what situation the two sisters, the Dashwood sisters, find themselves in?
Okay, so the Dashwood sisters live in this lovely house, and they have a half-brother, and they all share a father, and he's dying, he's on his deathbed. And, of course, this being Britain at the time, an all hereditary exchange of wealth would go to the son. As he's dying, he says to his son, "You have to take care of your sisters. They give them more than their allowance because they need to be married off, and I need you to promise that you'll do this for me." And the son says, "Yeah, okay, I'll promise." And then the guy dies.
The guy actually is Tom Wilkinson, we were surprised to discover in a very brief deathbed cameo. But then someone else intervenes, and that is the son's wife.
Harriet Walter.
Harriet Walter with the beautiful brown hair.
Yeah, pure poison.
Yeah, so what did you think of Harriet Walter as Fanny? She keeps popping up as a kind of malevolent society woman.
Well, the best thing about any character you loathe and despise is that you're secretly delighted when they appear on screen. She basically drives the whole film, really, because were it not for her scheming, this never would have happened.
Yeah, so the whole sort of first few minutes of the movie, we get no Dashwood sisters, we get the deathbed, and then we get the son, who's just inherited this estate and all this money, and what does his scheming wife convince him to do?
His scheming wife says, well, that's absolute nonsense that he needs to be married off. £500 is more than enough money for these four women. And turf them out of the home, because that's our home now. They'll be fine wherever they do. Go on, do it.
She has this wonderful line where she says, people always live forever when there's an annuity to be paid. If I spent the entire episode just quoting the epigrammatic wonderful lines from the screenplay, we'd be here forever, so I promise not to do it.
Epigrammatic. Very good, Brian.
Yes, thank you. But, Shawnee, were you surprised by this as the beginning of the tone of the film? Because I think you probably thought this was going to be all frou-frou frocks and romance and sappiness, and here we have this acidic comedy, which is really about money and bitchy family relation.
Therefore, I realized that I liked it.
Yeah?
Because I'm into films about money and bitchy family relations.
And let's be honest, isn't that what Adam's Family Values is all about?
Well, actually, Brian, you're completely right. It is entirely about that.
Fanny is the Debbie Jelinski of Sense and Sensibility.
Yeah, but, you know, those Empire waistlines just make everyone look pregnant. And Debbie Jelinski has much more fitted 90s Calvin Klein white dresses.
But yeah, this movie, I think, very, very significantly hinges upon money. It's not just about love, which is what we tend to think Jane Austen is all about, like finding your soulmate. In fact, it's how do women, at a time when they couldn't have their own occupations, they couldn't have independent fortunes, how do they find companionship within all these societal pressures of needing to live, needing to conform to what society says a woman ought to be? And Emma is at pains throughout the screenplay to point out the ways in which the sisters and the mother, the female family, is hemmed in by all of these restrictions.
Yeah, because they're more than capable women, like, you can tell that. But things like earning money, they're just completely forbidden to do. Like, it's really important to watch these films and just think about the actual laws and social order that existed, because it is mind-boggling. Emma says in her Oscar-winning speech, you know, Sidney Pollack asked all the right questions, like, why couldn't these women just get jobs? Well, quite.
Okay, so the Dashwood sisters get turfed out of the house and they go to live in a cottage in Devonshire on the estate of a distant relation. Now, you yourself, when you saw that cottage, were like, that would be a nice place to live.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It costs millions of pounds now.
I mean, now it costs millions of pounds. But in terms of four single women, the mother, Gemma Jones, who you might also recall from Bridget Jones's Diary, or this year as the farm mother in God's Own Country.
Yeah, she was great.
She is great. She's quite funny and sad. You pointed out the brilliance of the makeup.
It's one of those examples where if you give someone a white face and put a little bit of red line eyeliner underneath their eyes, it's just brilliant, because it looks like she's been crying the entire time, but also makes her look kind of like, you know, ghoulish in a sad way.
Yeah, well, she's sad. She's lost her husband. She's feeling under great financial pressure. They've moved into this house, Emma as Eleanor, the sensible sister, is telling them they can't eat beef, they have to cut out sugar. They do have two very friendly manservants, a cook and a valet. So granted, they're not in complete penury, but in terms of where they've fallen on the social order, they've definitely dropped down several rungs. Marianne, Kate Winslet, and Eleanor, Emma, now have to share a bed. They're freezing, you know, at night as they bundle under the covers. Now, someone we've not mentioned who comes into the story before they move to Devonshire is Edward Ferrars.
Yes, played by the wonderful Hugh Grant.
Now, do you often consider him to be the wonderful Hugh Grant?
No, I used to think he was the most annoying toff in the world, Hugh Grant.
Okay, so then why do you think he's wonderful here, and which version of Hugh Grant is he giving us?
Well, Hugh Grant is singular in certain things that he does. The problem with Hugh Grant is that you knew from the early 90s to the Bridget Jones era in the early 2000s that you were getting practically the same kind of person the entire time, which was this awkward, super posh, kind of like tough, wet wimp. And it kind of became really annoying for quite some time.
So why do you think it works well here?
Well, because this is a comedy of manners, and he is, you know, mannered to the nth degree. He's very, very good at that mournful, awkward bow. You know?
He does it about 17 times in the movie, and it gets more stiff and awkward depending on the difficult situations that he finds himself in.
Okay, I should also point out that Hugh Grant can be quite charming in a jovial kind of way. Well, this is after Four Weddings, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, so he's established himself as this kind of, like, handsome, you know, British moron with that accent, you know? Come on. Like, who has that accent, really, in Britain?
Darling, all you have to do is go to Oxford, and you throw a crumpet, and you'd hit one of those accents.
Fine, okay. Julie noted. But this really plays to his strengths, because he is funny, he is charming, and that's exactly what the character, you know, demands and delivers.
So the character is Edward Ferrars. He's actually Evil Fanny's brother, who happens to pop in. An attachment forms between him and Eleanor, and their scenes together are delightful because, you know, they're these two people who are so restrained in everything that they say. And Hugh and Emma can both be funny and both be, you know, uproarious in other films. They're tamping that down, and we're watching them, you know, say things like, "Oh yes, I find his conversation to be everything that is amiable and worthy." You know, that sort of thing. They just can't acknowledge that there is a blooming attraction between these two people, even though the sister and the mother and everyone's thinking, wow, they're made for each other. Maybe we can at least marry off one of these sisters.
You talk of feeling idle and useless. Imagine how that is compounded when one has no hope and no choice of any occupation whatsoever.
Circumstances are therefore precisely the same.
Except that you will inherit your fortune. We cannot even earn ours.
But of course, Evil Fanny is scheming and doesn't want Edward to marry the penniless Dashwood girls.
Yeah, because there are consequences. Not just that she doesn't want him to marry him, it's just that if he threw his affections in the wrong direction, he would be completely cut off from the family wealth.
But it's really important that we like Edward and that he's established as a sympathetic, attractive character, because he's going to disappear for a long stretch of the film.
Yes, and I believe during the interlude of the film, Edward goes off to Hollywood Boulevard and gets in a car with a sex worker, is that right?
Yes, named Divine Brown. Yes. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
But honestly, this is indeed, during the filming of this movie, was when Hugh Grant had his famous fellatio fiasco.
What big deal.
No, but honestly, you see, Sean, you were too young to really, I think, recognize how this, like, seemingly asexual British man had suddenly been revealed to be someone completely different from what we thought. But it is very funny when you read in the diaries, because he literally films the early scenes of the movie, has a break while the rest of them are filming the middle part, and they're all reading the newspaper reports about what's happened to Hugh. So when Edward Ferrars returns later in the film, I think I'm probably not alone in reading into Hugh's awkward bowing a bit of other kinds of embarrassment.
That's very good.
Emma constructs some really wonderful scenes where, for all of Hugh Grant's nerdy repression, he's actually really caring and really sweet. You know, he's very kind to Margaret, the young girl, and all of that.
Of course, he's not the only suitor who appears in the film, is he? Who could potentially marry off these young women?
Well, no. So what happens is, they find this house in Devonshire, and the idea is that Edward Ferrars will come and visit them, and presumably marry Eleanor. And as soon as they get to this house, another suitor enters into the scene. That's Colonel Brandon, mm-hmm. as played by Alan Rickman. Now, I was surprised, Sean, that you responded as well to Alan Rickman in this role, who, frankly, I've always found him as Colonel Brandon to be ever so slightly drippy and unappealing. But what did you... Who is he, and what did you think of him?
Well, you know, sometimes drippy people are genuine. Drippy people can be annoying, but drippy people can be good. And I think he's a good drip.
Well, he's also a drip with a wound, isn't he?
He is. It's a bleeding drip. Bloody drip. He's Colonel Brandon. He is this incredibly rich colonel who lives nearby, who was once betrothed to a young woman but was from a lower class and then ended up in a workhouse dying. So he really had his fingers burnt. Well, he wouldn't need to if that was the case.
Well, yes, he was sent off to India.
No, say it properly, Brian.
Okay.
India.
Yes, he was sent off to India to keep him away from this lower class woman. And when he returned, not only had she fallen into the workhouse, she'd fallen pregnant.
Yes.
And so, you know, his life has been colored by this tale of tragedy.
Yeah, and also not doing what the heart tells you in
yes.
the moment.
Yes, exactly, through family machinations.
What are your sentiments towards the late Alan Rickman?
My sentiments are that I really like the late Alan Rickman. I love his voice, that sort of, you know... I'm finding myself doing Scar from The Lion King, even though it's actually Jeremy Irons. But, no, Alan Rickman as... I think...
Alan Rickman never opens his teeth when he speaks.
Hmm, interesting, yes.
That's still Jeremy Irons.
Yes. Well, you know, it's... I think the thing is, like, there's a great affection for Alan Rickman, obviously, as Snape. People love him in Truly, Madly, Deeply.
I much prefer him as Hans Gruber in Die Hard.
Good. Yeah, no, it's a shame Alan Rickman never really got to sink his teeth into something a bit more meaty, but it's really important, I think, that we in the audience don't necessarily feel at the start that he's an appropriate match for Marianne.
Yeah, we're holding out for something better, as is she.
Yeah, because he is rich and composed and very stolid and stalwart and...
But where's the passion? Where's the fire?
As they say, Colonel Brandon is the type of man that everyone speaks well of, but no one remembers to speak to.
Yeah, that's such a brilliant line.
And Marianne, we've not talked much about her, but what kind of personality, what kind of sister in relation to Emma Thompson's Eleanor is Marianne?
She's the emotional one, and emotional in this, well, they're both emotional, but she's the more demonstratively emotional one. She is quick to anger, she's quick to tears, she's quick to, you know, exuberance. For better or worse, that's just what she is.
And she also does things like playing mournful tunes at the piano when she's sad, you know, passionately reading Shakespeare's sonnets in the parlor and saying that they, you know, everyone else is reading them with an insufficient amount of, you know, vibrancy. So that is definitely Marianne. You can understand why she would not be immediately attracted to the colonel.
Yeah, so who is she immediately attracted to?
Well, one day she and her younger sister Margaret go out walking in the rain, which is a typically kind of romantic sensibility thing to do, you know, like, oh, we'll commune with nature. Look, there's a bit of blue sky. Let's chase it. Little knowing that there are storm clouds brewing and they're going to be caught in a torrential downpour. She's going to plummet down a hill and sprain her ankle. And who comes riding across the heath but a strapping man on a horse with those lovely pointed sideburns and a nice square jaw. It's Greg Wise playing Willoughby.
Willoughby!
Willoughby! Is he human, as Eleanor later says? He's polite enough to ask if he may have the liberty to ascertain if there are any breaks to her ankle.
I.e. to touch her ankle, which I was saying to Brian must have been like a sexual frisson the like she's never experienced before.
He then carries her, you know, in his strapping arms back to the house, plops her on the sofa, and he doesn't want to stay too long for fear of leaving a watermark on the floorboards, but he comes back the next day. So Marianne survives pneumonia in this instance, but as she says, what care I for colds when there is such a man? Now, I believe, Sean, that you completely responded to the persona of Marianne.
Yes, I am totally a Marianne. I respond to her entirely, even though I sometimes pretend that I'm an Eleanor, unfortunately.
In what way could you relate to Marianne?
Oh, just the peaks and troughs of emotion, you know, the planting of significance in every, you know, man who looks at me. you know, planning my future. Yeah. Trying multiple futures. like every uncontrollable emotion that I then get petulant about.
I mean, you could understand how she's literally swept off her feet by Willoughby, and he gives her tons of attention over the next several weeks. It's also worth saying that she does things that are, you know, quite against the bounds of propriety.
She's, oh my god, even I know this.
Yeah, like what?
Well, he just pulls up in a horse and cart.
It may indeed be a barouche.
Barouche. Jersey equivalent. It's the equivalent of the American teen movies where the girl's talking to her parents, and all of a sudden there's beep beep, and it's like the guy is just literally driven up in a car. It's like, bye mom!
Yeah, but in like, and it's not just any car, it's in like a red Corvette.
Yeah, red Corvette. And it's like, she doesn't bring a jacket or anything. She just runs out and gets into the car and drives off. Like, it is that equivalent, because it's kind of like, wait, so this guy is literally pulling up, she's hopping in, she's mid-sentence and she's getting into the barouche, and she's gone.
And she's leaving poor Colonel Brandon in the lurch, and also looking on, as she so often is, with wry wisdom and concern, is Emma as Eleanor, who just thinks there is something suspicious about this Willoughby, and throwing yourself into a passion with him so quickly, is that a wise choice? At one point, he has told her that he's going to come by to the house and tell her something very, very important. Mother, sisters, everyone assumes it's a marriage proposal. They give them some space in the drawing room, and then they come in, and Willoughby, in a very confusing manner, storms out. Marianne is weeping. This sets Mother weeping. This sets Margaret weeping, and no one can quite figure out what's happened.
Exactly.
There's that wonderful shot. This is honestly my favorite shot in the film.
Which one? Involving the back?
Well, yeah, the back and the cup of tea. If you can relate to Marianne, I can totally relate to Eleanor, right? Because passionate emotions are going on all around you. You've got your own passionate emotions buried somewhere deep inside that no one seems to be taking any concern for, because she's basically, you know, in love with Edward, who's still not showed up at the house for some reason. Everyone else is weeping and crying and slamming doors. She's tried to bring them a cup of tea. They're having nothing to do with it, so she just sits calmly on the staircase. Ang Lee films it from an overhead shot that, honestly, the composition is worthy of Vermeer, and she's just sitting there in her bonnet with her cup of tea. I think Emma is really great when she's being shot in this film from behind. There's something about her back that is really, really expressive. You just read into that blankness whatever emotions are going on with Eleanor.
True.
Anyway, Willoughby has gone off to London for reasons that are not entirely clear. Basically, complications are ensuing. The girls now, neither of them are with the men that they seem to be attached to, Edward Ferrars or Willoughby. Both of them are behaving mysteriously and not around. They're still stuck in the country, and they're having to be entertained by Mrs. Jennings. You know, we've not said anything about the marvelous Elizabeth Spriggs as Mrs. Jennings.
She's this big, loud, vivacious dame, portly.
I mean,
she's a crazy old fat woman.
Yeah, she's this wonderful person who they say something like, "Well, she's a rich woman with a married daughter who has nothing better to do than to try and marry off everyone else's."
She lives with her son-in-law of her late daughter, and I absolutely love this dynamic. It's like it is the greatest son-in-law and mother-in-law relationship that's ever been committed to screen.
I see you, Miss Marianne. I think I've unearthed a secret.
Oh, oh, you've sniffed one out already, Mother. You're worse than my best point of flossing.
What sort of man is he, Miss Dashwood? Butcher, baker, candlestick maker. I shall winkle it out of you, you know.
She's horribly good at winkling.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised in the coda of this picture if they just decide to get married.
They should just have a spin-off TV series, you know, set on their estate, because he's funny. He goes off, like, hunting with his bitch pointer, and she has, like, a pet parrot named Pooter that she's always talking to. But basically, she is obsessed with gossip. She's obsessed with marrying off the Dashwood girls. She says things like, "There's not a beau for miles. Where are all the young men in this country? Are they in hiding?" And she concocts this scheme because she realizes that the Dashwood girls are pining away in deepest Devonshire. She's going to bring them to London, and if I don't have you girls married off by Michaelmas, it shall not be my fault.
Indeed.
So we go into this new segment of the film where they all trot off to London, and there's another important character who's been added into the mix at this point, a sort of random young woman who shows up whose name is Lucy Steele.
God, one of the most deplorable characters in this. Again, just like Fanny, is that when she's there, you're also like, what's she going to do next?
Yeah, and this is a classic Jane Austen where you relate to our two heroines and presumably to the men they're going to end up with, but everyone else is just like a deftly drawn, horrible caricature. So who is Lucy Steele?
Lucy Steele, from my interpretation of it, seems to be some kind of random acquaintance to Mrs. Jennings and her, you know, cohort. There's actually nothing really that wrong with her, but she's just deplorable. And can I say, the way to show how deplorable she is to give her the most basic wig possible. Basically, she's a basic bitch. She is, though.
She's the Jane Austen equivalent of a basic bitch. You're right. And if this were Clueless...
I know that's terribly misogynistic to say.
But it's really true, because she's sort of insipid. She's kind of feminine in the most societally approved way.
Yeah, the most boring kind of way.
Yeah, exactly. And she immediately makes it clear to Eleanor that she also knows Edward Ferrars, because they went to the same school together in Plymouth. And actually, if I may reveal to you, Eleanor, we are secretly engaged. And of course, this is horrible news, because Emma now realizes why Hugh Grant has never openly declared his love, because he wasn't at liberty to. He has been secretly engaged, lo these many years, to Lucy Steele. And I wouldn't put it past Lucy Steele that she, you know, she seems like she's all treacle, tarts, and daisies, but actually she knows that Edward might throw her over for Eleanor, and she's like insinuating herself in there, being like, don't you step near my man.
Well, this is the strength of her character, because we're not entirely sure if that's the case. I think your reading of it is entirely plausible.
So they show up at London, they're staying at Mrs. Jennings' house in Chelsea, and they're, you know, going around doing society functions, and Mrs. Jennings is saying things like, careful where you tread, girls, the horses have been here, which is yet again Emma pointing out that it wasn't all glamour in 18th century London.
Well, I mean, their teeth must be filthy.
Their teeth are filthy, there's dung everywhere.
They haven't washed their undercarriages in months.
Diphtheria everywhere. So anyway, a lot of stuff happens when they show up at this ball. Basically, all the characters are there, there's some dancing. You know, Fanny's there, the Ferrers, the other brother, Robert, is there. And who do they run into who has been completely absent from their lives for a period of time?
Willoughby.
Literally, Marianne from across Willoughby. The room shouts, Willoughby! Causing the music and everyone to stare at her. But he is not the same Willoughby that he was before. Oh, no.
No, he's not demonstrative and emotional and loutish. He's awkward, he's embarrassed,
And he shuns her. He goes off into a separate room with people who are really, really posh-looking, and this kind of willowy woman who just gives Marianne a withering stare, as if to say, who is this country bumpkin from Devonshire, and what is she to do with Willoughby?
So what's revealed is that, previously mentioned when Colonel Brandon was talking about his betrothed who ended up dying in a workhouse, but also with child, that child was a ward. A ward as in What does that mean again? Award of the state is meaning like, for example, award of the state is like under the state's ownership. So award is like a person who has to be under the, like basically like Britney and her father.
That is one, but I think the more appropriate one in this situation would be Batman and Robin. So Bruce Wayne has a ward whose name is...
Is that Robin?
Yeah, Robin is his ward.
Oh.
What's his name, like Dick Grayson, I think?
I don't know any about this, yeah, this legacy.
It's not as if you technically adopted them, but you are like taking care of them until the period of time when they can be an adult. And so in this instance, Colonel Brandon has adopted this poor, unfortunate, illegitimate child.
Yeah,
who
never gets to know the name or...
She never appears
in the film.
She
never appears, yeah.
But she is significant because in a rather contrived set of plot circumstances...
Yeah, it has to be said. Well, in a rather contrived set of plot circumstances, Willoughby has got this ward pregnant. And so Willoughby is now, you know, he's in the shit, basically.
He's been disowned by his own family because this pregnancy has come to light.
Yeah.
He's not done the upstanding thing and married the poor, illegitimate ward now impregnated, but has then run off to London and quickly arranged a new marriage to that willowy posh woman.
Icy posh woman.
Whose name we learn is Miss Grey, I believe, and yeah, who has £50,000.
£50,000,
which,
yes.
You know, we can do the math. If the four Dashwood sisters can barely survive on £500 a year, then £50,000 is fucking Trump level, right?
Yeah.
So Willoughby has just proven himself to be only interested in money and survival and keeping up appearances. Marianne is, of course, heartbroken. Eleanor is heartbroken because basically also what happens in London is Edward Ferrars shows up yet again. Hugh Grant returns from his dalliance in, L.A. with the characters from Tangerine. And he pops back again, and he has to confront Lucy Steele and Eleanor at the same time. And there's yet more awkward bowing, more, you know, in which it seems like Edward is indeed in love with Eleanor, but because he's betrothed to Lucy, nothing can happen. And it just looks like both sisters are going to go back to Devonshire. They've not been married by Michaelmas, and they may never be married, and their, you know, their love will never be fulfilled. At that point, they are on the road back, and they do a pit stop at the home of our favorite character actors, Imelda Staunton and Hugh Laurie. It's worth saying that this film is populated with an insane number of funny performances.
Yeah, so this character, Imelda Staunton's character, is actually the daughter of Mrs. Jennings, okay? Now, for ages, I was like to Ryan, I watched the whole film and was like, wait, those two are married? Because Imelda Staunton and Hugh Laurie have this weird dynamic. It's, first of all, I know Imelda Staunton's actually not that old, but she looks a lot older than Hugh Laurie does.
Oddly, she looks younger now,
yes,
I think, than she did in 1995.
Yeah, she is tiny, whereas he is really tall. She's this bundle of nervous energy, while he's this withdrawn, snipey, you know.
He's always reading the newspaper.
And like, commenting with these little barbs that are both really funny and also really pointed at the same time.
Yeah.
Mr. Palmer, do you know you are quite rude today? He used to be an MP, you know, Mrs. Dashwood, and it is very fatiguing for him, for he is forced to make everybody like him. He says it is quite shocking.
I never said anything so irrational.
Mr. Palmer is so droll. He's always out of humour. No.
So they put up the Dashwood sisters. Marianne makes that classic mistake yet again of walking in the rain, although this time she's doing it because
her heart is broken.
Her heart is broken, and their house happens to be on a hill overlooking Willoughby's estate. So she walks through the rain yet again. She stands on the hill. She looks over to Willoughby's house, and she recites the same Shakespeare sonnet, "Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is an ever-fixed mark," but it's not been ever-fixed in their case. She yet again falls ill from overexposure to the damp, and this time she is rescued not by Willoughby, but by Colonel Brandon, who brings her back to the house. The doctor has to call in a lot of laudanum to deal with Marianne, who seems to be on death's door. Now, Sean, we've not said much about the dynamic between the two sisters. There have been several scenes, sort of punctuating the action, where Marianne and Eleanor alone in their bedroom have debates about the nature of love, propriety, whether or not they're being open with one another about their emotions and feelings.
After all, that is bewitching in the idea of one's happiness entirely depending on one person. It is not always possible, we must accept. Edward will marry Lucy, and you and I will go home.
Always resignation and acceptance. Always prudence and honor and duty. Eleanor, where is your heart?
What do you know of my heart? What do you know of anything but your own suffering? For weeks, Marianne, I've had this pressing on me, without being at liberty to speak of it to a single creature. It was forced on me by the very person whose prior claims ruined all my hopes. I have endured her exaltation again and again whilst knowing myself to be divided from Edward forever. Believe me, Marianne, had I not been bound to silence, I could have produced proof enough of a broken heart even for you.
That is the real spine of the film for all of these funny character actors and for all these intrigues about whether they'll get with the guys. It's really this sisterly bond of these two women who view the world differently that is really crucial to the film.
It's as much about their relationship as it's about the relationship with men, because I think the thing is, why should we care about this in the way we do if it's just about people finding husbands? This is about female friendship, about sisterhood. It's about realizing the two of you are bonded more than just by law and blood.
Marianne says to Eleanor, you reveal nothing. You keep your heart locked. You won't tell me anything. You've known that Edward Ferrars is, secretly engaged to someone else, and you've kept it all this time. And she says,
yeah.
I too have emotions, Marianne, just because I don't wear them on my sleeve.
You must have really connected to that part.
I did. So, you know, their relationship is being frayed, and here is Marianne seeming to die. And she's being tended to at the bedside by trusty sister Eleanor, who looks at her in her unconscious state and says, Marianne, don't leave me alone. Please try. And that's where you realize that the sister relationship is the most important.
Absolutely.
Well, of course, Marianne does pull through.
She pulls through with the help of a certain Colonel Brandon.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's rescued her. He's got the doctor.
Yeah. He's also showing passion as well. He says, what can I do to help? I'm being driven mad if I cannot do something.
Right.
He wants this woman to pull through, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because he is in love with her.
And he can't lose someone else that he's loved. He is a wounded man.
He loves her in exactly the same way that he loved the previous betrothed.
I believe her name was Eliza.
Eliza.
Which is a wonderful name for a woman who falls into a workhouse. But anyway, so they go back to Devonshire. Marianne and Colonel Brandon's relationship is building. He very significantly makes a very ostentatious purchase of a piano.
Oh,
for
I love
the
that.
Cottage. Yeah. Always love a man who buys you a piano.
Oh, yeah.
So that they can play some duets together. He's also done something, which is he has installed Edward Ferrars as a curate.
Yeah, this is a painful part.
Yes, in his estate. Because Edward Ferrars has wanted to be a curate. He's not had a parish of his own, and he's been disowned by his own mother when the secret engagement to Lucy Steele has been revealed. So it seems like we're going to end up with a situation where maybe the now chastened and wiser Marianne ends up with Colonel Brandon, but poor Eleanor is going to remain a spinster because her one true love, Edward Ferrars, is going to be a curate on the neighboring estate.
With his wife.
Yes, with Lucy Steele. And I mean, can you imagine how horrible that would be?
Oh.
But who shows up one day but Edward? So he shows up, and they're all in a tizzy. He's arrived at the parish.
We should point out that all this information about Edward Ferrier has been relayed to the Dashwoods by the valet, who said that he met Lucy Steele, now Mrs. Ferris, who imparted with him the news of her marriage and to pass on her good news and well wishes to the Dashwoods, okay? He reveals this so matter-of-factly while lighting the fire one day, and all the Dashwood sisters quietly die a little bit more.
And of course, they all assume that Lucy's married Edward, but it is not the case.
Oh no, dear listener.
So Lucy, of course, cares more about money than any long-standing affection that built up at school in Plymouth. And so since Edward no longer has a fortune, she's now married off to Robert Ferrars. Now, Sean pointed out, I think, that it is confusing why the Mother Ferrars approves of the marriage to one brother and not to the other. I suppose it has something to do with the secrecy of it. I don't know. But anyway, it's a really convenient plot twist because it now means that when Hugh Grant finally shows up at the cottage for the very last time, mm-hmm. he is now, as he very slowly and painfully reveals to them, single.
Yes.
He is also in love with Eleanor.
Yes.
He can acknowledge it for the very first time.
Yes.
And he does it in very measured tones.
British.
Very well written. He says, I come only to profess, now that I am at liberty to do so, that my heart is, and always will be, yours. So that's his very eloquent line.
That's his last line, isn't it?
What is Eleanor's line in response to that? And honestly, I could tell you, Sean, the first time I saw this movie, so I saw this movie in a movie theater.
In Quincy, Massachusetts.
And I think it was Braintree, actually. But yes, I saw this film. Of course, I had no idea how it ended. The other people in the audience did not. As soon as Eleanor breaks into those heaving sobs, the audience, when you're watching with a crowd, erupts in laughter, tears. It is such a release of emotion. And this is where I think, like, obviously Emma's dazzling screenplay has provided so much joy throughout the film. Her performance, I think, is underappreciated. She has been so controlled, so measured, so intense, that then, when she is finally at liberty to express something, it comes mm-hmm. out as such a relief. It mm-hmm. is so powerful. Mm-hmm. It is more powerful than when Ennis Del Mar sniffs Jack Twist's flannel shirt at the end of Brokeback Mountain.
Well, we haven't seen that in quite a while,
no,
so I
okay,
think we should watch
it. I won't say it's more powerful, but it is comparable, right? It is this woman who has had so much buried within her. And actually, this is an interesting story. Emma has said that when she was thinking about how to convey that emotion in the film, she remembered herself that the death of her own father was something that she didn't immediately respond to or deal with until one day when she was at the bank, maybe months, years after her father had died, and she was writing a check, and just suddenly she started crying. And so she taps into that sense memory and I think gives what is both comic and emotional as this huge, like, release at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. The other women in the house don't know what to do with Eleanor heaving sobs in that way. They run out, they look into the window from the treehouse, they see that Edward has now gone down on one knee and proposed marriage.
The nice thing about this is that we're just being told it's happening rather than getting to see it.
And then we cut ahead to a wedding. It's technically not a double wedding because I think Edward and Eleanor have been married first. This is the wedding of Colonel Brandon and Marianne. All the local townspeople are dancing around maypoles and carrying cakes and things. Willoughby, significantly, is up on the hill
this
on his
steed. This is a bit
contrived,
isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, he's up on the hill, he's looking down at it, and do you know what he's really thinking? I'm going to marry Emma Thompson as soon as this shoot is done. So basically, Emma, off of the back of Sense and Sensibility, she got not only another Oscar for the screenplay, she also got a really hunky husband. So she ended up marrying Greg Wise.
And also, I pointed out to Brian before we started recording, this means that Willoughby, now that he got the ward of Colonel Brandon pregnant, in a roundabout kind of way, he is now a family member of Colonel Brandon and Marianne.
I mean, it's a complicated one because you have to ask yourself, will Marianne have anything to do with this ward now that she is the wife of Colonel Brandon?
She's going to turn into Fanny.
Yeah, basically, maybe she becomes Fanny and she kicks out the ward. I mean, who the hell knows? Because, like, I mean, basically, she'd have to live with a woman who'd been impregnated by her former lover.
Yeah.
Basically, it becomes like Dynasty.
Basically, yeah. I like it.
I think it's really significant that as they're riding away in the carriage and the villagers are cheering, what is the last shot of the film?
Money!
Yeah. I guess this is some sort of tradition of the time when rich people get married, that they throw coins, gold coins, up in the air for the hoi polloi to just pick up. But it is yet again a sign that while Emma has constructed the humor and she's constructed the romance really, really well, she's always at pains to remind us this is a story about social conditions and that this is all motivated because of money.
Yeah.
So, Sean, that is Sense and Sensibility, the film that you waited for over a decade to watch, that you barely even could bring yourself to consider watching the trailer.
2 decades, darling.
Okay. Have you come around?
I've come around.
Yeah? How do you feel about Emma Thompson's status as the only person to win an Oscar for acting and for writing? Only person, not even woman, person.
Yeah, it's absolutely fabulous.
Yeah?
Yeah, it truly is. I believe Ruth Gordon might have been nominated for writing. You know, Ruth Gordon...
Ruth Gordon was nominated many times for writing, but she did not win.
Yeah, so Ruth Gordon would be the closest one.
I basically, you know, the thing about Emma Thompson, she's written a few other films, obviously, Nanny McPhee. I think she wrote Effie Gray. Do you remember that one?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, there was a time where I went to see every single Emma Thompson movie. That broke down at a certain point.
Yeah, you have had multiple opportunities to see Emma Thompson films, and you have not.
I haven't seen The Love Punch. I haven't seen Effie Gray. I haven't seen Meyerowitz stories. You know, I think Emma actually does a lot of uncredited work on screenplay rewrites and passes on screenplays in Britain these days. You know, her career as a screenwriter is hardly over.
Uh-huh.
But in some ways, Sense and Sensibility is really her swan song in terms of a big, accomplished leading role. I can only hope that we will have some more from her in the future, now that her daughter, Gaia, is a bit older. You know, I honestly think Emma Thompson should do one of two things. She should either do more leading roles for herself, or she should run for political office.
Well, here's the thing. Tulip Sadiq is so unpopular in Hampstead and Kilburn that it would make perfect sense for Emma Thompson to step into a previous Oscar winner's role.
A previous two-time Oscar winner's role.
Exactly. So she's in good company then.
Yeah. I mean, Emma... Presumably she'd be with the Labour Party, do we think? Or would she be a Green? I feel like Emma might be
a
Green.
No, I think Emma is a sensible, pragmatic person. She would run for the Labour Party.
Yeah, only sensible, pragmatic people go to Antarctica and, like, chain themselves to icebergs and things like that.
I don't think she ever did that, darling.
Oh, well, anyway. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to go into two directions in the remaining episodes of our Emma Thompson series. With our bad Emma Thompson movie, we're going to speed ahead past Sense and Sensibility into a film she made later. And in the crazy episode, we're going to go back to one of the origin films of Emma Thompson. We're going to see her be equally comic, equally dramatic in equal measure.
We're going to see her tits.
We are indeed. And we're going to see more of those heaving sobs. What are those films going to be? Well, you can check on our Twitter feed where we're going to be teasing them. That's at Broad Appeal Pod. We would also really appreciate it if you would leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Emma Thompson deserves it. Until the next episode, I have been Brian.
I'm Sean.
And gosh, Emma is a goddess. We'll see you very soon.
Bye-bye.